Have you ever gone to a birthday party and expected a gift? You know, like you're going to go to someone's birthday party. Maybe it's your brother, your sister, a good friend, a coworker. You're showing up, and on the way, you're driving to the birthday party, and you're thinking to yourself, boy, I wonder what gift I'm going to receive. Like, I wonder what I'm going to get today. This is like going to be amazing. I'm just looking forward to, like you would not, right? Like you wouldn't do that. You couldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. And it even sounds kind of weird. But when we think about church, and when we think about we're driving into church or we're anticipating attending a service like this, we intend to be with Jesus, especially like Christmas, this time of year. Sometimes we get this weird kind of language amongst ourselves and we say, what am I going to get out of worship today? What am I going to get out of... That's just as odd, believe it or not, as going to a birthday party and expecting to get a gift. In reality, what we all should be doing when we show up to a worship service is, if it is truly a worship service, then it is, what am I going to give today? I have this gift, and each one of you have a gift that as you're driving to church, as you're walking into the facility, as you're greeting one another, as you open your Word of God, it is time for you to give something. It's time for you to worship God. And so how do we do that today? I know that when you're buying Christmas gifts, and man, I'm terrible at it. It is not one of my love languages. I am awful at giving. I am so awful at giving gifts that the other night, maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, Susan and I were in our home, and there's an advertisement that came on, one of the shows we were watching, and it came on, and she goes, I want one of those. And I said, cool. Grab my phone. Ordered. Christmas gift given. And I looked at her and I said, honey, I need a couple tires for one of my mountain bikes. Christmas over. And you're like, well, that's not very romantic. Yeah, it's not. But thank you, Jesus, that I married a woman who, her love language is not gifts either. Words of affirmation, acts of service, we're big on that, right? So we focus there. And I could not tell you why, because I still don't know why, my little wife would want such a thing for Christmas. Because you know what it was? Like, it's a gift that if a man would have bought this gift for his wife, like without her saying I want it, if it was just him going out and going, ooh, I'm going to get my wife, it would be a gift that you would get in big trouble. It was this little steamer thing that she can use to clean furniture. I asked her why she wanted it, and she goes, because it makes my life easier. So I'm giving you the gift of making your life easier. So, okay, that makes sense, right? That makes sense. But I would have never thought if I would just shop for my wife. But in other ways, when we think about gift giving to one another and we think about our love language and what it means to give, gifts just aren't that important for Susan and I. It's more the other way around. It's showing my love and appreciation for her by giving her words of affirmation and by doing acts of service for her. So as you know, I was off a couple weeks ago. It took a whole week off, and the first 2.5 days, I just did stuff for her that probably should have been done a long time ago around the house. And she goes, when are you going to take a break and go have some fun? I was like, I'm telling you, I love you. I got this. Well, as we come to worship today, I want you to think this Christmas season. And I know most of you in here today, the kids are all gone. The kids are in the other room. And I know for the kids, they're thinking, oh, what am I going to get? We can leave that to the children. That's fine for the children to be thinking that. That's fine. We'll leave that to the children. But most of you in here, if I know you like I think I do, you're probably excited about what you're giving more than what you're receiving, right? Because you're an adult. You're an adult. You can't wait for your loved ones to open the gifts. You would take your gifts and like shove them to the corner and go, here, look at that, and that's where you're going to find your joy. Because you know, we express joy that way. We express joy in worshipful giving. And I want that thought to permeate your Christmas celebration. As you spend time with loved ones, as you attend worship services, as you enjoy the sounds of the season, I was in Stater Brothers the other day, and there was a wonderful Christmas hymn being played. And I thought, what a fun time. What a fun season. Let me go buy another half gallon of eggnog or two or three or ten. Because if you think about that, joy expressed in worshipful giving really is the best way to celebrate this season and to appreciate all that God has done and is doing in our life. And I know that there's a lot that He has yet to do, right? There are a lot of things that God hasn't accomplished yet. Are there some things on a, to use the seasonal language, are there things on your Christmas list right now that normally it's a prayer list maybe, but this type of time of year you change it into a Christmas list and you would show that to Jesus and you would say, this is my Christmas list, Jesus. This is what I need you to do in my life. Would we all agree there are some things on there that He just hasn't done yet, right? And we get kind of trapped in this notion that if He hasn't done it yet, that He's never going to. And just because He has not yet, it doesn't mean that He will never. And I think that as we journey together, there's a lot of that in Christianity. Sometimes it's called the now and not yet of the kingdom of God. That we live in this space where God is already ruling and already reigning and already exercising His sovereign control and dominion. And then there's some other spaces that Jesus hasn't just worked out yet. And that, I know, is kind of a big, big hard thought theologically, but it's more of a difficult issue emotionally, especially when the not yet deals with your family, especially when the not yet deals with some health issues maybe. Maybe when the not yet is really approaching a deadline that you're like, oh Lord, like help. And so I want to invite you to look at some characters in this Christmas story that are probably familiar to you, and what I want to do over the next few minutes is deepen your understanding of some very familiar people. And I want to do it from this perspective of Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 18. And as we start looking at the people that you and I commonly call the wise men, or the magi, or the magi, or the magus, if you want to use the singular. But if you want to look at these characters, these folks, these men that showed up from Babylon, most likely, from an area you and I would know as modern-day Iraq. So some Iraqis traveled to Israel. Now, if you said that in 2023, you're like, oh, man, that makes me nervous if Iraqis are starting to travel. And if you go and get some people from Iran and make them travel to Israel, like, that makes us a little nervous today. But about 2 years into Jesus' life, most likely, these wise men show up. And so if you have a nativity scene, what I want you to do is take the wise men and put them out about mid-January. Don't let them be like part of the first little scene. They're not there yet. They didn't come to the manger scene, as we like to typically call it. They probably showed up at Jesus' house 2 years later. And so these wise men, what they were doing is they were doing something that I think we all do to a certain extent. And so let's get to know them, and I'll reveal that in just a little while. But the first thing we come to understand as you look in this passage is that those who seek Jesus do so to worship Him as the, get this, and I know this is going to rub some people the wrong way, but get this, as the King without geographic or ethnic boundaries. Let that settle in for a moment. I really love the Church of Jesus Christ in America to get their mind around this kind of peace. That Jesus, as King, is not the President of the United States. Nor was He ever the King of England. Jesus is the King of kings, and His kingdom knows no ethnic or geographic boundaries. There's a lot throughout the Scriptures, I think, that we need to start looking at in America today and understand that Jesus is not necessarily concerned with, hey, this is my territory and this is my tribe and this is my people. And these wise men understood that in a very, very unique way that I think brings us to an amazing challenge. And it is this. First of all, when they came, it says in verse 1 of chapter 2 of the book of Matthew, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is He who was born King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it arose and have come to worship him. Now, mind you, these folks weren't Israelites. They were Semitic, most likely, but they were not Israelites. And when they had come, they were coming well-educated. In fact, they were probably some of the most well-educated people of their day. And when they came, these men came with this massive tradition in history. Let me see if I can do it from memory and not read it to you in my notes. I'll try to do it justice. If I confuse you, call me later. Well, I'll try to lessen the confusion. But these people, they had a rich history. They were people from, if you remember, in the Old Testament, Abram, whose name became Abraham, right? He was from the land of the Chaldeans called Ur. Now, these men have a history back beyond that. They were part of that group, right? They were part of that group from which God called out Abram and made him Abraham. Very important, because when God took Abram, and you can read the story starting in Genesis 12. You can read the story when God took Abram. There was no such thing as the nation of Israel. There wasn't anything called the Jewish people. There was no nation state. There was no group, no tribe, nothing. It was the land of Ur of the Chaldeans. And primarily, if you look at the language around that day and you look at the names of the people that were associated, in that area they were primarily moon worshipers. Okay, but they also had a group of folks that became, through Abram, as they moved through history, they became monotheistic, not polytheistic. So that was the first major shift in that area through what God did when he took Abram, pulled him out of the land of Chaldeans and changed his name to Abraham and sent him to the land of the Canaanites. And what happens there in Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Did I put that in your notes? I did. Go with me. I just messed up. Let's stay right there. Let's not go there yet, Wes. Don't go there. Stay right there. Stay right there. See? I tried to do this without reading my notes. But these men, the Magi, we'll deal with Abram in a second. Because of how they studied, they understood history, astronomy and astrology, and they became the most highly sought out people to advise kings and other leaders. Okay? So this group then became monotheistic through Abram, and by the time we get all the way to Daniel, these folks are the ones that everybody wants to hear from. Okay? So when God called them out, notice this. Some people have a hard time with this phrase, king of the Jews. It's better translated king from the Jews. Big difference. Big difference. Because when you look at Jesus as king, and when you take this statement that he is a king without geographic or ethnic boundaries, and that rubs people the wrong way, and you're like, wait a minute, I even struggled with writing that and saying that to you today. But when you look at it, you think, wait a minute. It wasn't as though God looked at the political geographic landscape of the day of Abram and said, oh, Jewish people, I pick them. I pick them to be my people. That would be favoritism. Some people would say, as they claim Christianity is a nonsense religion because it's racist, that might be racist. If he looked out and said, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, pick the Jews. Oh, they're the ones that are the best. Oh, they're the ones that I like the best. Oh, they're the ones that have the best this or the best that or behave the best. No. There were no such people. God took one man, Abram, changed his name to Abraham. He had a promised son, Isaac, who had another promised son, Jacob, whose God name changed to Israel. The 12 tribes of Israel became the nation of Israel. God birthed a nation to bless all other nations. And the blessing for all nations was Jesus Christ. Because he, therefore, is the king without ethnic or geographic boundaries. And he is not to be trapped into any of our systems. Do I love America? Absolutely. Do I believe that you should vote and do all that? Absolutely, participate. We need wonderful Christian people in government and being involved, and you need to do that, and you need to pay attention as an American. But do not make the mistake that somehow the church or somehow America is somehow God's new favorite. Don't do that. That's a grave mistake. And understand that the very reason God called and created the nation of Israel was to bless all other nations, not to exclude them, not to belittle them. But by the time you get to Jesus, most Jews thought that if you weren't Jewish, you were barely even human. Because they thought, oh, God picked us and we're special because we're His. Not the case. Not the case at all. So these wise men, what did they know? Why were they coming 2 years into Jesus' life? Why were they coming to worship Him? Maybe they remembered, because they were students of history, and I gather they would remember a little story from the book of Numbers. From the book of Numbers, there's this really weird story in which King Balak of Moab hired a prophet named Balaam to curse the Israelites. And he just couldn't do it. It's the weirdest thing. Like, he signed up to curse them, and every time he opened his mouth, he blessed them. And he was really frustrated by this. And notice this blessing found in Numbers chapter 24. This is something that these folks would have remembered and would have formed their perspective of the world. In verse 15 in Numbers 24 says this, "And he took up a discourse," this is Balaam, "the oracle of Balaam," this is what they remembered, "the oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob," in other words, Israel, "a scepter," that's a symbol for rulership and kingship, "shall arise out of Israel and shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemies, shall be disposed. Israel is doing valiantly, for one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of the city." And they were like, oh my. So who's that? That was something that they always thought, well, who is that going to be? I see him, but not now. He will, but he's not here yet. This formed an anticipation among the Jews and all those that were paying attention that out of Israel was going to come a ruler that would supplant all other rulers. Built an anticipation. But they also understood, as I went to a moment ago, a little too early, Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. When it came, it said, "Now the Lord said to Abram," you know him as Abraham, "go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing." Notice that. Why did he make the Jews so great? So that they would be a blessing. Why did he create a brand new nation, a brand new people, to be a blessing? If you're great at something, it's always, God always does this. He makes people great so that they can be a blessing, so they can show up and give, so they can show up and make every environment that they find themselves better. Because that's the way God works. He says this, "I will bless those who bless you, and I will who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all families of the earth will be blessed." It's called the Abrahamic covenant. That's the covenant of all covenants. That's where the Jews find their identity. That's why they were searching and looking so hard and anticipating for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years that there would be a Messiah, a Savior. The mistake of the first century Jews with Jesus is that they believed that this leader was going to be political and free them from the nation of Rome. And Jesus had no desire to do that. Never did. Jesus did not free the nation of Israel from Rome and make them a world power again, but that's what they wanted. And that's typically what people of God do in whatever country they live in. They worship God, they love God, they love Jesus, and then they just assume that God's going to make them the greatest people of all people. And that's a very poor assumption. Because Jesus is not here for nation building. He's here for kingdom building. It's a big difference. And he is the king without geographic or ethnic boundaries. And if you really understand the prophecies and the promises and the covenants, it's always God's global, and some would even go further than global and say cosmic kingdom. It's always the bigger picture. But we struggle. And so these wise men knew this. They knew the Abrahamic covenant. They knew the oracles of Balaam. And so, as wise men, they came. And they came to worship Jesus as a king without ethnic or geographic boundaries. And I'm asking you and I to do the same. As Americans, whatever God has made us great at, it's to be a blessing. Because he's building his kingdom that is global, that is multi-ethnic, doesn't have geographic boundaries. That's why when we have problems such as we have in the world today, you usually have Christians on both sides of whatever war you're discussing. Whether it's Russia and the Ukraine. We're a global church, Church of the Nazarene, of 2.6 million people. We have churches in the Ukraine. We have churches in Russia. We have churches in Poland where people flee to. And at the beginning of that war, we had people flooding from those parts of the world through our southern borders into the Church of the Nazarene that was helping people find homes all across our country. If we look today at what's going on, you understand the theology of what's going on. I pray that you do. I pray that you understand the theology of what's going on between Israel and Hamas. The theology of it is very clear. But I hope that you also don't get so calloused to understand that there are people hurting, right? And there are guilty people and innocent people paying a very high price. And yes, the theology of it you understand. But don't forget the humanity of it. Don't forget that God does not rejoice in the destruction of the wicked or anyone else. And so we must understand that and join these wise men in that. Moving further along in our text of Matthew 2, we understand that those that reject Jesus, this is King Herod, often do so to retain their own authority, not because of a lack of evidence. So you're coming to worship this king, and your purpose is to worship, your purpose is to give, your purpose is to surrender, but those who say no to Jesus typically do so because they want to remain in control of their own lives. They don't want to surrender to this king. They don't want to give up authority. They don't want to give up their own goals, their own desires, their own ambitions to serve this king. They want to hold on to their power at all cost. Notice, though, the worst thing in our culture for someone that has power is to lose it. Look what is taking place in our nation politically today. Most of it is a power grab, not, oh, I want to serve my country. I don't buy that. Sorry, I'm a skeptic at heart. Someone shows up and saying, I want to provide for you, I want to give to you, I want to help you, I want to do this. I'm like, what are you trying to get? What are you trying to do? I don't know, I'm just that way. Excuse me. But notice that he sought truth, this is Herod, for the purpose of satisfying his own trouble. Verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him, and assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people, and he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For so it is written by the prophet, O you of Bethlehem, O in the land of Judah, by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Wow, what a truth. Did he want to go worship Jesus? Did he want to go with the wise men? No. He wanted to find where he would be, and what did the prophet say so that he could take him out? He rejected the long-standing truth in favor of his own desire. These wise men were following a truth and knowledge of the oracle of Balaam and the covenant with Abram. They were following this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. They were following stuff out of Daniel chapter 9. They were following all of this history and all of this theology, and they were coming to worship. And meanwhile, you had Herod saying, tell me where the child is, because I want to know where he is, because I need to eliminate him because he disrupts what I want for myself. Whew. Notice this. He sought it out on based on false pretenses, verse 7 and 9. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them at what time did the star had appeared. And he said to them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring word to me so that I too may come and worship. And that was just a lie. And no intent on worshiping Jesus. And while I'm on the subject, as a Christian and as Christians, do you and I get bothered when people use Christianity for their own selfish gain? I do. When people proclaim to go to this church or that church or be a Christian and be this. And you know, there was a time when those little fish stickers were all over advertising ads because it helped, like, you trust them. So if they wanted to get your business, they put the little fish thing. And then there was this thing called the Christian Businessmen's Directory. I don't know about all that. See, it sounded like this. Moving on from there in our text, we also discover that those that honor the identity of Jesus express their joy in worshipful giving. So on one hand, you had the wise men following age-long history of anticipation and desire and coming and following and finding Jesus. That what generations had longed to discover, they were discovering. And then you had a king, a political leader, trying to hold on to power. But then you have this joy. And notice, this isn't a joy where they found something that they were waiting a week or two for, or a month, or something that maybe dad and mom told you to watch out for, or grandma. I mean, this was hundreds and hundreds of years. And they were seeing it. Notice verse 9. After listening to the king, they went their way, and behold, the star that they had seen went and rose, when it rose and before them, until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. They opened their treasures. They offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed from their own country by another way. See, these gifts symbolize what was going on in their hearts. See, that's what people with the love language of gifts do. You have something in your heart, and you see something in the store, and that matches, and you want to go buy that for your loved one. Because what's in your heart, and what you see on the shelf, and what you know, you want to put all three of those together, and you're like, oh, they'll love this. This is going to be outstanding. This is going to be amazing. That's what was going on in their heart. All of the generations and all of their knowledge about all of these different subjects, these big-brained, big-headed people, were now just falling down and worshiping Jesus. Because finally, what they'd been longing for was right in front of their face. And these gifts are pretty interesting. You've probably done studies about what these gifts are like. But very quickly, see, these gifts symbolized that they gave gold because he was a king. They gave frankincense, which is a perfume from the trees of India and Arabia, because of his deity. And then they gave him myrrh. This is the weird one. Myrrh is a perfume used for embalming dead bodies. Because if they knew the oracle of Balaam and they knew the covenant with Abram, they also understood the prophecies of David and Elijah, who knew that this king was not coming to establish an earthly kingdom. This king was coming to die a death to bless the world. And so his gift reflected that. That their gift said, yes, you're a king. Yes, you are God in the flesh. And yes, you are going to die. And for these three things, we worship you today. Wow. Think about this. Think about what they understood about Jesus. And then what they understood about Jesus when they came in contact with Jesus, they just could not help but to worship him. and see the value of these gifts. I want to put a quick quote on the screen. Notice this with me, please. The gifts are intensifiers of desire for Christ Himself, in which the same way that fasting is. When you give a gift to Christ like this, it's a way of saying, the joy that I pursue is not the hope of getting rich with things from you. I have not come to you for things, but for yourself. And this desire I do intensify and demonstrate by giving up things in the hope of enjoying you more, not the things, but giving to you what you do not need and what I might enjoy. I am saying more earnestly and more authentically, you are my treasure, not these things. Pastor John Piper. You are my treasure, not these things. I'm giving you these things. You don't need them. Jesus didn't need any gold. Jesus, he's God. He doesn't need anything. And these guys could have used this. So they took what they could have used, and he did not need, and they gave it to him, because why in the world would you drive to a birthday party expecting to get a gift? You wouldn't. You shouldn't, and you couldn't. You would never do that. Oh, but you would show up with a gift that you're like, oh, I kind of want to keep this. I want this for me. If I bought you a new mountain bike, I would want it. I would be like, yeah, I give you my old one. I'll keep this one. But they came to give. So my challenge for you, very, very simply, very, very simply, is to express your joy in worshipful giving. I pray that you can do that this season. That you will do that. And if we all did that, then the next thing for us corporately is very simple. It's almost identical. It is this. The last slide, please. That's it. Thought I'd put it up there. But may we, as a community, worship by giving. There it is. That's all I want. May we do that. May we worship by giving what he really doesn't need and what you really could use, but you're so wrapped up in him and it's about him, not the stuff. And you are understanding that all the way through the scriptures, it talks about this Jesus. And what does this do? This also creates in us a sense of all of the generations and the centuries of the anticipation of the first arrival. Now, how long have we lived anticipating his second? 2,000 years. Folks that follow Jesus have been waiting for him to return. And wait for him to return, we continue to do. But we worship a king without ethnic or geographical boundaries. We worship a king who doesn't need anything. But we come to worship.